From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Nora Vincent is a journalist. A few years ago, on a dare, she put on some loose men's clothing and took a late-night swagger down a dark street in New York. She discovered that men who ordinarily stared or catcalled instead avoided her gaze. The experience prompted Nora to try a huge experiment to turn herself from Nora into Ned for 18 months, a woman walking in the shoes and life of a man. She bulked up, sprinkled on a 5 o'clock shadow, and worked with a voice coach to change her speech. Nora, as Ned, joined a men's bowling league, went to strip clubs, dated women, and step by step, it all turned her notions about men and women upside down. And then there's this. Nora Vincent is gay. So move over, Brokeback Mountain. This hour on Point, a smart, no-nonsense woman tells us what it's like to be a man. You can join the conversation. Ladies, have you ever wondered? Gentlemen, can a woman, even a woman in pants and a bowling league, ever really know? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Nora Vincent. Her new book is Self-Made Man, One Woman's Journey into Manhood and Back Again. Nora Vincent, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
It's a terrific book. I'm sitting reading as a man and saying, wow, this woman has really got a beat on some things here. You didn't waste your time as a man. Thanks for doing it. It's just wonderful.
Well, I'm so glad to hear that. I hoped that would be the case.
I want to deal right off the bat with Nora Vincent as a gay woman and your description in the book, because we want to know who it is who's putting on the suspenders and the trousers here. I mean, you say that practically from birth you were a hardcore tomboy, to such an extent that it makes you think there must be a gay gene, instinctive loathing for dresses, dolls, and frills. You know, why, for example, you write, did I insist on dressing like a ranch hand when I was barely out of diapers? So help us know who's putting on the men's costume here. I mean, is this the same as any other woman posing as a man for 18 months, or were you halfway there, if you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, I think part of the reason when people say, why did you do it? Well, the short answer is because I could. I think that I had advantages that other women wouldn't have, partly just because of the way I look. I'm tall. I've got enormous feet, as you said.
Size 11 and a half. That's impressive.
Yeah. And a deep voice. And my features are pretty androgynous. I've always been an androgynous person. And so I think that it was easier for me to make that transition. And that's the beginning, of course, of any project like this is figuring out, is it even feasible in the real world to really make this happen?
I mean, you write about it, and I was trying to think it through. On the one hand, as you say, you're gay and kind of on the tough dyke side of that. On the other hand, you were raised and lived as a woman. So the stepping over to the other side of the line would still be a real difference in experience for you. I guess that makes it a kind of crossover like in some sense any other woman's might be.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, all women are essentially socialized by the culture in the same way, just as all men essentially are socialized in the same way. And there are a lot of course, studies of infants that support that kind of thing. But from a very early age, I think you're programmed. And I really learned that. I mean, I think I was always considered a masculine woman. Mm-hmm. And then as soon as I became a man, so to speak, I was seen as an effeminate man. So suddenly all of these behaviors that I actually didn't even realize how feminine I was until I started to cross over, and then they started popping out all over the place.
You end up much more sympathetic than one might expect at the outset. This isn't a hatchet job on men. I mean, you see strengths and you see weaknesses, but on balance, the message I'm taking away here is this is no easy road. And as a woman stepping over, it's like, wow, that's tough.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of the question was, okay, so in the post-feminist age, what's it like to be a guy? I mean, you know, women, I feel as a woman that we have been liberated. Our choices have been expanded. And I think I wanted to continue. If you assume that the feminist conversation until now, mm-hmm. and everything that's been written, you know, from Steinem all the way up, say, to the Naomi Wolfs, if you digest that and you accept that, and then you say, well, okay, so what's the next step in the conversation? Mm-hmm. I think you have to accept that, you know, there was a standoff that was reached in the so-called gender wars. And to continue the conversation, I think you need to examine, in the so-called patriarchy, what was the male role? We know what the woman's role was. We know what the straitjacketing was. And I think we've redressed a lot of those problems. But I wanted to know, so what was the man's straitjacket? And can we talk about that now?
We want to know how you did it and hear your illustrations of the moments when you got your insight. But I love the way you described the incident that kind of sparked you off in this direction. That nighttime walk down the street in New York, we right away feel the nuance that you're bringing to this. And I wonder if you could read a bit, Nora Vincent, for us from the new book Self-Made Man about that evening and your experience.
Sure, yeah. I had lived in that neighborhood for years, walking its streets where men lurk outside of bodegas, on stoops, and in doorways much of the day. As a woman, you couldn't walk down those streets invisibly. You were an object of desire, or at least semi-prurient interest, to the men who waited there, even if you weren't pretty. That, or you were just another piece of pussy to be put in its place. Either way, their eyes followed you all the way up and down the street, never wavering, asserting their dominance as a matter of course. If you were female and you lived there, you got used to being stared down because it happened every day, and there wasn't anything you could do about it. But that night in drag, we walked by those same stoops and doorways and bodegas. We walked by those same groups of men, only this time they didn't stare. On the contrary, when they met my eyes, they looked away immediately and concertedly and never looked back. It was astounding, the difference, the respect they showed me by not looking at me, by purposely not staring. That was it. That was what had annoyed me so much about meeting their gaze as a woman. Not the desire, if that was ever there, but the disrespect, the entitlement. It was rude, and it was meant to be rude. And seeing these guys looking away deferentially when they thought I was male, I could validate in retrospect the true hostility of their former stares. But that wasn't quite all there was to it. There was something more than respect being communicated in their averted gaze, something subtler, less direct. It was more like a disinclination to show disrespect. For them, to look away was to decline a challenge, to adhere to a code of behavior that kept the peace among human males in certain spheres just as surely as it kept the peace and the pecking order among male animals. To look another male in the eye and hold his gaze is to invite conflict, either that or a homosexual encounter. To look away is to accept the status quo, to leave each man to his tiny sphere of influence, the small buffer of pride and poise that surrounds and keeps him.
Nora Vincent, reading from her new book, Self-Made Man, One Woman's Journey into Manhood and Back Again. She spent 18 months as Ned. And Nora, I love that phrase, the small buffer of pride and poise that surrounds and keeps him. Describe for us, as a woman, what is that buffer? Is it something men have? And in your experience, women do not, that small buffer of pride and poise.
Well, I think we have it in a different way. But I think the way I try to describe that night is that it was as if somebody had changed the channel, or, you know, the frequency had suddenly, and I was privy to a language that I had never been privy to before. It was as if there were these vectors of interest going back and forth between men that were invisible to a woman's eye because she wasn't receiving them. And so suddenly I was able to get inside that and hear a different language. And I think when I talk about that buffer of pride and poise, I think what I learned over time, that was a theme throughout, that men have a very complicated relationship with each other. And I think that, you know, for example, in the early handshakes that I had with men as a man, I was so surprised by this kind of bonding that I think men have. It may be a superficial bonding, but it's an understanding. It's this presumption of goodwill.
More forthcoming, more immediate goodwill, as you describe it, than you see among women at first meeting.
Right. Usually, I mean, I was struck by that often when you meet strange women as a woman, that we're raised to be competitive with each other. Is she prettier? You know, competitive for male attention, whatever else. So there's a little bit of standoffishness there, whereas with men, I just felt this rush of inclusion. Whereas from the outside, you look at that and I would say, oh, come on, what's all the macho ceremony about?
But the popping handshake. Right there.
Yeah.
Nora, tell us, just give us the logistics here. Were you persuasive? How did you put on the man effect, and did it work?
It did work, surprisingly enough. I used something. I consulted someone I knew in the theater, and I used a substance called Stoppel paste, which professional makeup artists use.
This is the stubble.
And it's a lanolin. And,
mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, what?
This is the stubble. This is the cheek stubble.
Right. It's a lanolin and beeswax based adhesive that's invisible. So I would apply that on the parts of my face where I wanted the stubble to stick. And then to create the stubble itself, I used wool crepe hair that looks and feels very much like some wigs are made out of it, and they use it again in the theater and in film. And I cut it with a man's beard trimmer into the tiniest pieces I could make them into. And then I used a makeup brush, and I just blotted it onto my face as evenly as I could, and that's how I created the beard.
Men's clothing, a man's haircut, your natural-born size 11 and a half feet. When men or women saw you, did they buy it? Did they think, there's a man?
Well, nobody ever questioned it, as far as I know, and I revealed myself to a lot of people, and they were always shocked. And the only thing that I ever did get, as I say, was a fair number of people thought that I was gay. But nobody ever read me as a woman.
Nora Vincent, stand by. We've got to take a short break here. There's a lot more we want to learn from your experience. We want to hear the stories of Nora's life as Ned. We're glad to have you. Nora Vincent's new book is Self-Made Man, One Woman's Journey into Manhood and Back Again, 18 Months as Ned and What She Learned. Listeners, you can join us. Nora Vincent ends up sympathetic toward men. Can you see why? And what would a woman learn walking a mile in men's shoes these days? Women, can you imagine crossing over persuasively for 18 months? Men, what do you think females just don't get about males? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the life of men from a woman's perspective. Writer Nora Vincent spent 18 months posing as a man among men and among women. She's brought out of it her new book, Self-Made Man, One Woman's Journey into Manhood and Back Again. Very reminiscent of John Howard Griffin's 1961 book, Black Like Me, where a white writer put on the character, the face of a black man, this time a woman. As a man, Nora Vincent. You can join the conversation. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Men, what do you think women just don't get about you? And does it sound like Nora Vincent is on to you? What do you make of the more welcoming bonding Nora Vincent found among men? Does that ring true? Men, women, what do you think? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Nora Vincent, begin to take us into your experience here, wherever you like, maybe with the bowling league. That was amazing to watch and read. How did that unfold?
Well, you know, I realized, although I had a fruitful experience the first time I walked down the street as a guy and just experienced the world in general, I found over time that wasn't yielding enough usable information. So I decided that I needed to create or evoke or find circumstances that were discreet and that had casts of manageable characters. And I really wanted to meet men who didn't know me and get to know them over a period of time and make friends with them, because I was really interested in male friendship. Mm-hmm. So I thought, well, you know, I guess I'd always thought about Robert Putnam's book, Bowling Alone. And
yeah.
I thought, well, you know,
let's bowl together.
Bowling is really the ultimate sort of social barometer. And so I just had that sort of brainstorm, and I called up the local bowling alley, and they happened fortuitously to have a slot open, and they said, come tomorrow night. And so there I was without having any time to practice.
And when Ned showed up, a woman dressed, disguised as a man, how did the guys receive you, him?
Amazingly graciously. You know, not only because I guess, you know, here I was a stranger, and I think it became clear pretty quickly. They told me, you know, they noticed the first thing about me was my hands. And there was a class thing going on here. These guys were carpenters and machinists and things. And, of course, you know, I think the worst I've ever had is a paper cut. And they noticed that right away. So there was that. And but they were just amazingly welcoming. And, you know, they didn't know me from Adam. I just walked in out of nowhere. They didn't know how I bowled. Eventually, they, of course, figured it out. And they were even gracious about that and trying to help me to get better. And
not too good at the beginning.
Yeah, it was terrible.
What about the after the greeting, the handshake, the sort of welcoming open? What was the quality of conversation, the texture of conversation among the man you bowled with, as interaction, as opposed to, let's say, it was women of the same number out for an evening?
Well, certainly there's some predictable stuff. I mean, there was a lot of talk about what was happening with the local sports teams. And, you know, there were some more touching things that one of the guys, his wife, had been diagnosed with cancer. And that was an interesting moment to watch the way that he told us about that. I mean, he probably used maybe 20 words to tell us. And there was very little said, but a lot was communicated, not only by him, but by his friends in sympathy. And that was the beginning of learning. You were talking about this buffer between men and I was saying there's a complexity. It's an odd thing, you know, this mm-hmm. initial inclusion. And then there's this sort of understanding, you know, this cultural language that they share and they know. Women tend to overspeak. You know, we talk about everything where our antennae are always twitching. Mm. And they just seemed to know, I'll say a couple of words and I can't say more because it's just not done. But you know that I care and you know I'm here. And the way that they processed this emotion together was fascinating to watch.
That's often described as a kind of emotional bluntness or unemotional quality in men. Did you find it that way?
Well, that was the thing I realized. It was a little bit like anthropology in that it's like going to another culture, and if, you know, they're talking in a different language that you don't understand, you think that it's not intelligible speech. And I think that women tend to interpret men's silences or men's terseness as either a lack of emotional life or a lack of emotional intelligence or an unwillingness to communicate. And I think it's not that at all. I think it's just a very different way of communicating, which, in fact, you mentioned Brokeback Mountain. I mm-hmm. think that did a wonderful job of showing, you know, they said very few words to each other, but there was a lot in it. And so it was a way for me. I think women have a certain cultural arrogance there, you know, that we think we're just better communicators, and I think we're just different communicators.
You talked about speaking with these men, the manner of speaking. You actually went to a Juilliard voice coach for some tips on how to speak more like a man and changed your voice, as I read you, Nora, as Ned, to sound more male. Can you give us an example of that? Give us your male speech.
Sure. Well, she went over with me. A lot of it became a psychological projection that started in the body. And she would talk about this thing I was just mentioning that she said, you know, this is admittedly stereotypical, but generally speaking, women use more words. They tend to, as she called it, bankrupt their own breath. Mm-hmm. They're trying to get out all the words. They think they're not going to be heard, so they have to sort of push the words out, whereas a man will sort of sit back and pronounce with a more terse authority. So for me, as you can hear, I'm slowing down the way that I'm speaking. I would use fewer words. You can hear that my voice is getting deeper. And that's, I've got that register there. So I would just slow down, shut down, and then I was Ned. And that's really how it worked.
We hear it. You're the man, at least for 18 months. It took a toll. We'll hear about that. You put yourself into all kinds of situations. We'll talk about them. I want to begin to invite our listeners in. From Buffalo, New York, Jasper's calling. Hi, Jasper. You're on the air.
Yes, hello. Good morning to you as well.
Hello, sir.
Ms. Vincent, good morning to you as well.
Good morning.
The reason I'm calling today, Ms. Vincent, I'd seen the same information you're displaying today on this radio program on Good Morning America. Mm-hmm. I appreciate you taking the effort to be as forward in your approach to understanding the opposite sexes, how we communicate in a sociological point of view. Mm. Thank you for that. But
oh, sure.
I must really represent the fact that as a human being, the reaction that you gave or received and the reaction that you put out was strictly a mask. You are a woman.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Inside, you will continue to be a woman biologically on this earth. Mm-hmm. I am a man. If I dress in women's clothing today, the reaction that I'm getting is not clearly the true reaction.
Jasper, where are you going? Are you think that she, Nora Vincent as Ned, if she's fairly persuasive in that mask, can't even begin to taste what the man's experience is like?
Taste, a good word for that. You can sit down to the table, and you can put a meal out in front of you. If you smell it, you have not tasted it. If you can describe it, you can say it's of this ingredient, it comes from this matter. That's basically a description. To actually take the food into your mouth and get a taste from it is physical. I can't physically be a woman when I mask myself as a woman.
Jasper, let us put it to Nora Vincent. Nora, what do you say? Jasper's challenging how close, how deeply in this kind of exercise you can really understand the experience of the other gender.
Well, I think he's right in the sense that this was a sociological sort of experiment in the sense that, I will never be biologically male. I didn't take hormones, and that will come out. I'm sure we'll talk about this later. One thing women will never get about men is the sex drive and what testosterone does to your body and your brain. And it's just there's no way that I could experience that. I could feel empathy for it. I think I understand it better. But yes, I could not be a man. On the other hand, I do think that what the experiment was really about is not being a man, but appearing to be a man. So how does the world treat you when it believes that you're a man? And it, as far as I understand it, in all the people that I've spoken to with whom I interacted, they believed that I was a man. Therefore, they treated me as a man. So I think in that sense, I did get the experience. I didn't have the internal feeling of what it's like to live in a man's body. That's very true.
Jasper, will you grant that much? Sounds like we may not, Jasper may be gone. Let's get another call here from Nashville, Tennessee. Hamid is on the line. Hi, Hamid. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm fine. How about you?
We're good. What do you think, Hamid?
I was just in touch with that. Sometimes it's difficult to be in a man. She understood and she sympathized. That's what my point is. And another question, how did she feel before she put this makeup as a man's wife?
As
What did I think of men before I did it? Is that what you mean?
Yes, exactly.
Great. Nora?
I think I approached them... I think I was standoffish. I think I... Like many women, and I think this is probably accentuated in an all-female lesbian world, I really was guarded around them. I was suspicious of them. I felt that, you know, they were a threat to me in some way. And I think I probably suffered from that prejudice that they just simply had it better. So it was really a huge turnaround for me to realize that none of those things are true.
Nora Vincent, take us into your dating experience. Here's where I felt your empathy, sympathy meter really rising for men. It was tough to be on that side, the man's side of the dating equation. Describe your experience there.
Well, this is where I think in part it was helpful to be a lesbian in this project because I've dated women as a woman. And I can tell you that it's a world of difference dating a woman as a man because it suddenly, you know, we're socialized in such a way that we understand each other's signals. We understand what the lingua franca of females is, and we engage in that every day without even thinking about it, as do men. And so suddenly, there I was with a woman without that common bond, that common language, that common gesturing and so on. And I suddenly felt deaf to them and they to me. And it was really disconcerting to suddenly feel cut off in that way. And so communication became a lot harder. And I also was just stunned by how often I felt hostility coming at me right off the bat or suspicion. I mean, the same things I just described to you about how I felt about men. Mm. And it just felt incredibly unfair. I felt as though, yes, it's true, as Jasper said, I wasn't a man, but... You know, I'm a human being, and to be treated like sort of less than a human being in the sense that, well, we know what you're about. You're, you know, in contrast to the guys who would, it was this presumption of goodwill. With women, it was almost always a presumption of ill will that you are a cad until you prove otherwise.
But what about your manner of approaching women as a man? I mean, as a lesbian, it's not the first time you've approached women in a dating situation. Were you putting on a whole different approach here? How did you decide how to, you know, could you use the same tools that you used as a lesbian in the opening sort of dating dance, or did you restrict yourself to some, I don't know, crude vocabulary of come-ons?
I didn't, but I found that, again, I had a lot more leeway as a woman approaching another woman, whereas as a man, suddenly I felt very limited in what I could do, and I felt that I was tiptoeing around things, whereas as a lesbian, I felt free to essentially say and do what I wanted because I was meeting someone on equal terms, whereas as a man, I felt that I was coming at it from the underside, and I had to work my way up. I kept having to prove myself to them. And also, I think that I realized, of course, in the mating game in general, women are not the ones who do the approaching. And I think so we don't understand how hard that is to walk across the room and try to present yourself to a total stranger without seeming like an idiot or seeming like you're, you know, doing some terrible, you know, come on that's right, loathsome. And right. And the sense of rejection that you get, I mean, the dismissals can just be immediate. And it's just one word no, or just the way they look at you as if, you know, I said it's as if you're inferior produce at the supermarket. And you just feel about an inch tall, you know. And so I really, after a night of that, you start to feel like, wow, you know, this is taking a lot of emotional energy.
You had a male buddy in that particular endeavor. What advice did he give you when it came to cranking it up?
Well, he tried to caution me because, you know, he'd been there. And actually, he had a great time laughing at me because he knew he was really teaching me a lesson. You know, he watched me because I was really gung-ho. You know, I thought, okay, here right. I am in drag. I'm passing. Right. I really want to see what's going
to
happen.
I know how to do this. Yeah.
And so I just would go up to these women and he would try to warn me. He'd say, you know, you might want to take it a little easy before you. And then I would come back looking, you know, my tail between my legs right. and he'd just laugh at me. And he'd say, see, you know, he told me a funny story about that, about a guy he'd known in college who, you know, had a lot of women coming in and out of his room, and he wasn't a particularly good-looking guy.
No,
and
no.
He finally said to him, you know, how do you do that? And he said, well, you know, I get rejected 90% of the time, but it's that 10%.
That's guy talk.
So, you know,
talk.
It's that just 10%. Going after it again and again, and finally maybe right. The odds will let you in.
Right. Dave's calling from Boston. Hi, Dave. You're on the air.
Hi there. I think this is a fascinating subject, and thank you so much for doing it. I can't wait to read the book. But my question was, did you ever feel, I'm thinking to Boys Don't Cry, did you ever feel threatened or, you know, that you'd be found out and then this could turn in some way to violence? I hate to take us down a dark road of the experience. It's been very positive thus far, but you know, depending on where you did this in the country, I could see that you'd be running a little bit of a danger in terms of that.
You're talking about Boys Don't Cry, the movie with Hilary Swank, and of course you can look around at plenty of news headlines as well. Nora Vincent, how about it?
Well, you're not introducing a dark topic because the book ends very darkly. And it ends that way for that reason. No one did harm me, but I did become increasingly afraid, especially the climax was when I went away for a weekend retreat with the guys in my men's encounter group. And I was just – I kept thinking about it, Hilary Swank in that movie, and I just thought – or Tina Brandon – and thinking, you know, they could just string me up to a tree. And these are guys who are trying to work out some of their anger toward women, and I would be, you know, an interloper. And it precipitated a breakdown in me by the end of it. I did just the pressure and the fear really got to me in the end. So, yes, I did feel that.
On the other hand, with your bowling group, when you finally came out and said, hey, I'm a woman, I was struck at how gracious they were with you. They just took it straight on board, having gotten to know you, I guess, and dealt with it.
Yeah, they were pretty amazing that way. And part of me wonders whether it wasn't in part that thing where, you know, as a guy, you're not supposed to admit that you didn't know something.
Yeah, I suspect.
You know, so they sort of said, oh, I knew all along. They didn't say that, but they did say, you know, just sort of like, oh, yeah, I guess, you know, all right. And so that was, you know, that was pretty great. And then I think what they realized, this happened, of course, with some of my dates, was that they realized they just liked me as a person and it really didn't matter. And they eventually just saw the humor in it and they went right into making the chick jokes. You know,
right.
They talked about, you know, I had a headache, you know, because I'd been building up to the stress that night of telling them. And they just said, oh, well, I don't have an aspirin, but I might have a Midol, you know, and that started the whole round of chick jokes. And I was very good natured about that. And they teased me about my big feet. And, you know,
right.
What was that?
You're actually, though, quite kind to them in the way you described the way they talked about the women in their lives. Not so misogynistic, the contrary, at least in the bowling crew.
Yeah, they really did express a wonderful reverence for their wives. And, you know, that was one of those things where you really are the fly on the wall, and they might have said all kinds of things, and they didn't. I mean, to a man, they expressed just spontaneously their reverence and love for their wives, and that really touched me.
Dave, thanks for your call. We're talking with Nora Vincent. Her new book is Self-Made Man, One Woman's Journey into Manhood and Back Again. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, and by Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, Bicon.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the life of men from a woman's perspective. Writer Nora Vincent spent 18 months posing as a man among men and among women. The book she brought out of that is Self-Made Man, One Woman's Journey into Manhood and Back Again. You can join the conversation. Nora Vincent ends up sympathetic toward men. Can you see why? And what about the dating game? Does the man's role there look like a horror? And I guess bigger, what's up with the new gender-bending buzz all over Brokeback Mountain, Trans America, the movie, and now Nora Vincent living like a man? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Susan's calling from West Des Moines, Iowa. Hi, Susan. You're on the air.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Earlier when it was mentioned that, you know, welcoming handshake that she received from men, I've been in kind of a male-dominated business world for profession for over 25 years now, and I noticed that men, for the most part, are more welcoming. They're more welcoming in, you know, an office situation. They're more welcoming as clients, and I find it to be really sad. In the beginning, I thought it was because there weren't as many men, or excuse me, women in the workplace, and so they were maybe territorial and uncomfortable and didn't feel like they belong there.
Right.
But as time goes on, I see just a real competitive situation, and I really try to make an effort not to be that person, not to be competitive with the younger women coming into my company. I try to, you know, help. I try to mentor. I try to teach. But I find it to be uncomfortable. I have three daughters, and I see it among their friends, too. And it really makes me sad that, for some reason, women are that suspicious of one another, and they aren't as welcoming.
And you look across that gender fence there, Susan, and see something maybe to envy. Let us dive further into that. Nora, you wrote a lot about it. I want to get your response to what Susan's got to say. But maybe first, I'd love if you could read a bit more about that handshake and the kind of gender solidarity behind it. I mean, you write about what's there and ultimately what's not there. Could you read a bit for us?
Sure. As he extended his arm to shake my hand, I extended mine, too, in a sweeping motion. Our palms met with a soft pop, and I squeezed assertively the way I'd seen men do at parties when they gathered in someone's living room to watch a football game. From the outside, this ritual had always seemed overdone to me. Why all the macho ceremony? But from the inside, it was completely different. There was something so warm and bonded in this handshake. Receiving it was a rush, an instant inclusion in a camaraderie that felt very old and practiced. It was more affectionate than any handshake I'd ever received from a strange woman. To me, woman-to-woman introductions often seem fake and cold, full of limp gentility. I've seen a lot of women hug one another this way, too. Sometimes even women who've known each other for a long time and think of themselves as being good friends. They're like two backward magnets pushed together by convention. Their arms and cheeks meet, and maybe the tops of their shoulders, but only briefly, the briefest time politeness will allow. It's done out of habit and for appearances, a hollow, even resentful gesture bred into us and carefully but rarely felt. This solidarity of sex was something that feminism tried to teach us, and something it now seemed to me that men figured out and perfected a long time ago. On some level, men didn't need to learn or remind themselves that brotherhood was powerful. It was just something they seemed to know.
Nora Vincent, reading from Self-Made Man. What about Susan's observation in Des Moines, Nora? What were the limits of this gender solidarity that you found here? How do you end up looking at it, men, women?
Well, it's very complicated because, as I said, you know, it's interesting if you put these two together, the observation I made on the street about the eye contact or lack thereof among men, there are these strict boundaries of behavior that aren't particularly friendly, and there's a sort of territorialness that can happen too. Mm-hmm. But then mixed in is this notion of this camaraderie and brotherhood. And I mentioned that because, you know, of course, one of the slogans of feminism was sisterhood is powerful, and you sort of think, why did they have to tell us that? You know, it seemed that it was something we needed to learn. And I certainly described in my work situations, I found a lot of that in the office with other women. We seemed, I mean, I think we're just raised to be competitive with each other. And we do a lot of backstabbing. And, you know, we think, I mean, we're raised also to be nice. You know, we have to make appearances seem good. And mm-hmm. so we're very polite on the surface. But underneath it, there's sort of this roiling anger or competitiveness. But of course, then there's the whole other aspect of female friendships. When you get past that, of course, they're very deep and profound. And so it's not to say categorically, of course, that women are superficial and men are not at all. It's just a different dance that we do. And it was very striking to me. And I do think it's still true that women do have trouble, you know, competitiveness. Men are very competitive too, but it's a very different kind of competitiveness. They want to beat you when you're at your best. They don't want to beat you on a handicap. I learned this in the bowling league. Whereas, you know, playing competitive sports with women my whole life, it really was this kind of undercurrent. We just want to win. You know, it's that old Gore Vidal saying, it's not enough that, you know, you succeed. You want to see your competitor
Someone
fail.
Someone has to lose. They have to fail.
Yeah.
Take us into another front here. You mentioned it earlier, but the realm of the male sex drive. Now, as a woman, as a lesbian, you've got a unique vantage on this, but how did it look from the inside with the guys?
Well, again, going into a strip club, you might have said, if I were a heterosexual woman, well, you wouldn't enjoy the experience, of course, because you're not attracted to women, but I am. So it was, I think, one of those circumstances where I came really right up against the differences in between male and female sexuality, that I really hated having a lap dance. I found it a big turn off, and the whole atmosphere, which was really catering to, I don't know, maybe the male id, you mm-hmm. know, was just really off-putting to me. And I think that you know, it's not to say there are plenty of men I've met who say that they've never been to a strip club and they don't like that atmosphere either. But I think it's hard not to talk in general terms here. And so I did find that even though I am sexually attracted to women, that I needed, as I think most women do, a mental connection or some kind of preamble surrounding circumstance that isn't just about bodily function.
What was your understanding ultimately of what they were up to in their minds?
Well, many of them described it as a bodily function, almost like going to the bathroom. You know, it's just – and that was part of what I was saying. I think it's impossible, however different men across the spectrum may manage this in their lives. You know, not all men go to strip clubs by any means. Mm-hmm. But there is a very big difference in the sexual drive between the male and the female animal, and I think we will never understand that because we just don't have the same hormonal balance. And they tried to talk to me about that. And I think there's a certain amount of shame that they would feel about where their sex drives led them because, you know, they were civilized people. They knew what was expected of them. They felt that this was not good behavior. Maybe it entailed infidelity to their wives of some sort. So it was a real struggle. And again, I guess it made me feel sympathy that it must be a very hard thing to try to repress something that's so basic and not your fault, you know?
Not your fault. Brian's calling from Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Hi, Brian. You're on the air.
Hey there, Norma. I'm really glad to hear you saying what you're saying now. It's something I've been saying for a long time. I mean, I was really glad to hear you say that you felt women had achieved a measure of equality. I definitely felt that men have social issues that are well understood by other men, but the spirit of stoicism that's bred into men sort of prevents us from complaining out loud about it.
Mm-hmm.
it's viewed as weakness. And I've had a beautiful, brilliant feminist girlfriend, in the past, who I argued at great length with about this, who, insisted that women were not equal, that they were still oppressed by men, that, they had body issues forced on them by men, but these unreasonable expectations of beauty. And I've always said men have it really just as bad.
Brian, where are you looking for sympathy then, or where are you hearing it from Nora Vincent?
Well, basically in the fact that, she recognized this, from behind the lines, that that men really do have their own issues, but maybe that they're not as well publicized, or that maybe they don't speak out about it as much, but they're just as evident.
Brian, thanks very much for that. Nora Vincent, let me put it to you. How far are you willing to take this theme of sympathy for men? Are you the new men's champion from your 18 months in wingtips?
Well, I think that probably the best way to put it is what he said. That's what I've said in the past. I think that women, it's part of our cultural definition that we're allowed to express our feelings and we're allowed to say, this is bothering me. So, a lot of people wrote books. For the last 30 years, women have been writing books about, look, this is what we're pissed off about. We need this to be addressed. And a lot of that has been addressed. In my opinion, in my life as a woman, I feel, let's put it this way, I feel that the definition of womanhood and what's culturally acceptably female is much larger than it ever has been, and I think it's much larger than what's acceptably male. So I think half the liberation has happened, and men, yes, men's problems. Women don't have more problems than men. It's just that they're different problems. We each have our own problems, and they're very different problems, and I think men's have been less well publicized because they are not allowed to talk about them. It is perceived as weakness. It's just not acceptable to whine, so to speak.
In your life as a journalist, you've written for the New Republic, New York Post, Village Voice, Washington Post, had a syndicated column for the Los Angeles Times, and you were in this kind of interesting category that emerged late 90s and later, the conservative gay columnist. Is this a backdoor experiment into, conservatives are often seen as being more sympathetic to the patriarchy. Is this Nora Vincent's conservatism coming out by another channel?
Well, actually, it's interesting because I wanted to write this book precisely because I was sick of writing about politics and I never will write about it again. I found it very divisive, and I think I've changed a lot as a person. I'm really not interested in the polemic. Mm-hmm. And so I think that in certain circles it might be seen as a conservative conclusion. But in fact, the men's movement, which is really voicing these concerns about men's voices being heard, it's not defending the patriarchy. In fact, it's indicting it further. It's saying that the patriarchy consisted of two interconnected roles that men and women were playing, and that men had a straitjacketed role just as much as women did. Now, granted, they had many advantages socioeconomically, politically, and so on, but I don't think that's nearly as much the case now, and I think that it's sort of an emotional revolution that maybe needs to be – that's being called for. So I don't think that that's a particularly conservative, stance.
Bruce is calling from Ashby, Massachusetts. Hi, Bruce. You're on the air.
Good afternoon. Good morning, I guess.
Hi. What do you know? What do you see, Bruce?
Well, I'm from the other side. I'm a male working in a female environment and often misconstrued, I understand. Sometimes not even to my knowing.
What environment, Bruce?
I'm a nurse, so I work with women, mostly. I'm the minority.
Okay, and how do they understand you as a man? Do they get you?
I'm sorry, do they what?
Do they get you as a man? Do they understand you?
I was really surprised. I was at work, and my wife now, who I worked with and was my friend then, said to me that women, some of the women at work considered me a flirt. And I was taken quite aback by that because I didn't think that at all. I was thinking I'm just being an equal. I'm, going over and whatever, patting them on the back or talking to them or sharing something with them, joking with them. And I was very, very surprised to hear that some of them anyways thought I was a flirt. And also my wife, I guess, was kind of jealous about that, seeing me being friendly with someone else. To me, it was just natural to have camaraderie.
Bruce, we've got it. Let us get Nora Vincent's 18-month reality check on that, Nora. And thanks for your call, Bruce. Nora, what about it? men and the way they come to women, come on to women, how much sincerity did you find?
Well, it was interesting that he used the word camaraderie, because I think maybe what was happening there is that he was trying to do what he knew friendship was, which was maybe a male-based model, and it wasn't working very well with women because women's friendships are different, or because you could go up to a woman, you know, we can touch each other, we can flirt even with each other, and it doesn't mean anything sexual because that's just acceptable within the boundaries of female friendship. Mm-hmm. So it sounds to me like he was running up against that kind of clash of styles, and they just didn't quite know. I found that, you know, as a guy, for example, I said, you know, people see weakness in a woman and they want to help. They see it in a man and they want to stamp it out. I think you can run into, with the same behaviors, very different reactions depending on what the situation is.
Our time is short. There's a point in the book at which you talk about men, your sympathy with men kind of carrying the weight of the world on their shoulders. And at that point, I had to pause and think, wait a minute, I know women carry an awful lot of weight of the world on their shoulders. What do you mean about the division of weight carried there?
Well, I was very careful, I think, to say that, you know, women as homemakers and now, you know, trying to juggle career and home carry a tremendous amount of weight of their own.
No kidding.
It's certainly not to take anything away from women who do that. And I think that was the complaint of feminism, that being a homemaker is very hard and that they weren't getting the recognition for that as a job. So let's say that up front. But it's just that I think maybe women, in making that complaint, you know, they thought, well, it's going to be all fun and games getting into the work world and being a CEO. And it's important because the movement was all about choice, and it's terrific that we have the choice. But I think we need to understand that being the working stiff in the gray flannel suit, being the person who's expected to bring home the bacon no matter what, is a very hard burden to bear. So again, it's not to say that they have more of a burden or that they're shouldering a bigger burden. It's just a different burden that I think hasn't been discussed as much.
Nora, we've just got a minute left. You're back on the other side of the line now. I guess two questions. One, as a lesbian woman, any temptation to go back, or are you all done with that? And two, when you see the man coming down the street now, do you see him in a new way?
Absolutely. I would never want to go back. I love being a woman. I feel that it's a great privilege in our culture. I wouldn't necessarily say that in other cultures, but in ours, I feel just wonderfully renewed in my femininity and more in touch with it. And yes, I do treat men differently. I see them differently. I behave differently toward them, and I feel closer to them.
You still pitching your voice down when you want to get a man's attention these days?
Depending on the situation, you know, if I need to assert myself, yeah, I'll just sort of become terser and lower.
That's fantastic. Nora, it's a terrific, insightful book. As a man, I'm instructed by you, my fellow citizen woman, and a thank you for it.
Thank you very much.
Nora Vincent, her new book is Self-Made Man, One Woman's Journey into Manhood and Back Again. Listeners, you can continue this conversation or download the On Point podcast or subscribe to our daily newsletter all at our website, onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Eileen Imada, Stefano Katsonis, Matt Lieber, Rekha Murthy, Tanya Rally, James Ross, Christina Russo, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Matt Odette and Angel Coselli. Our senior producer is Joe O'Connor. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.